Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation to come and visit back to Perimeter. Last time I was here was 8 years ago in a very different room and talking about a very different topic. At the time, I was thinking about supersymmetry. And in some sense, my interest in physics beyond the Standard Model has led me into this crazy world of jet substructure. And this crazy world of jet substructure has encouraged me to think more about QCD, both perturbative and non-perturbative aspects of it, which I'm going to tell you a little bit about today. Now, my title is too ambitious, and I realized this when preparing my slides. And so instead of talking a lot about non-perturbative aspects, I put a lot of the non-perturbative stuff in backup. And I'm going to tell you about some surprises that have come up in studying the perturbative aspects of QCD with a tiny bit of non-perturbative at the end. Okay, so my outline of my talk, just for those of you who are not part of this jet substructure world, give you a little bit of the sales pitch for jet substructure. I'll be a little bit brief on that point. And then I want to tell you about two surprises in QCD that have come about from thinking about jet substructure. One is a new theoretical concept that we call Sudikoff safety. And this idea of Sudikoff safety has expanded what we think is actually calculable in perturbative QCD. I'll give you examples of observables which you think you have no analytic control, but surprisingly, you actually do have analytic control moving beyond the standard paradigm of perturbative calculations. And then I'm going to turn to another concept, mutual information with the truth. This is an idea taken from the information theory literature. And one of the kind of puzzles or conundrums in jet substructure is actually very easy to visualize when you adapt some concepts from information theory. And I'll show you a little bit of the calculations that you can do when you take this information theoretic approach. Okay, but I'm going to start just by giving you the sales pitch. I think a number of you have seen sales pitches like this, but just to get everyone on board about where this is starting. Okay, so jet substructure. So this is an event from CMS, which is entirely uninteresting. It's just a die-jet event. Or at least it looks like a die-jet event until you look at the substructure of these jets. That is, instead of just having collimated sprays of particles that are proxies for quarks or gluons, instead you have collimated sprays of particles which are further lumped into substructure, and you see that there's subjets inside these fat jets. And so on this side, you can clearly see three-prong substructure. On this side, you can see two-prong substructure. And you can convince yourself that this actually is not an ordinary QCD die-jet event. Rather, this is evidence for boosted top production. In particular, you have top anti-top produced with large transverse momentum with respect to the beamline, and the decay products of the top, which we usually think of being a three-jet final state, where the top decays to a B and a W, and the W decays to QQ bar, that the three decay products of the top are all collimated together. And the characteristic opening angle of the decay products scales inversely with the transverse momentum with respect to the beamline. So as the tops get more and more and more transverse momentum, their decay products are more and more collimated, which tells you that jet substructure becomes more and more important as you go to high energies. You can convince yourself that these really are tops by calculating the invariant mass of jets that have this kind of three-prong substructure, and you see nice peaks here at 170 GeV. So those of us thinking about jet substructure for new physics searches, we want to make sure we're sensitive to new physics searches that might decay to standard model resonances, but in this extreme kinematic regime. So as we go to higher energies, this boosted regime becomes inevitable. So as just one example from CMS in a search for a die-jet or die-top resonance Z prime, as the Z prime mass gets heavier and heavier and heavier, these tops get more and more boosted with respect to the beamline. And you see this nice crossover here in this search for Z prime, where at low Z prime masses, where the tops don't have that much of a boost, the best search strategy for looking for this TT bar final state is to look for a resolved top, that is, top decaying to three well-separated jets. But at this transition point of one TeV, that corresponds to tops that have a transverse momentum of around 500 GeV. And if you plug in this formula for the typical angular separation, for typical angular separations used in LHC analyses for jets like 0.5 or so, you see that indeed at 500 GeV you get this crossover, where instead of looking for three well-isolated jets, you end up doing better by looking in this boosted regime by finding one fat jet and then coming up with ways to identify substructure in that jet. And actually, these searches are going all the way out to 2 TeV, where you're starting to run into detector granularity effects where all of the decay products at the top are already in a quite narrow cone. And that's something that the community is facing as we go to even higher energies with 13 and 14 TeV running on the horizon. So with high energies, this boosted regime becomes inevitable, and so jet substructure techniques are becoming more interesting as time goes on. Another reason why jet substructure is coming to the fore is because of the high luminosity of the LHC, which tells you that pileup is inevitable. And so if you're looking, for example, for one of these boosted top quarks that has a characteristic invariant mass of 170 GeV, and you layer on all the secondary collision debris from uncorrelated proton-proton collisions within the same beam crossing, what do you get? Well, this 170 GeV is distorted. So this nice blue curve that you have that's peaked at 170 GeV if you have none of this pileup gets shifted, distorted, as you start layering on this, this uncorrelated radiation. And you need some kind of way to look inside of a jet and try to remove radiation that you think is contamination, separate it from the radiation that you think is coming from the underlying hard top. And so there's various techniques. One that I developed with Lian-Tao Wang and David Krohn is called trimming, and it performs spectacularly well, better than we thought it would on data, which basically takes these distributions, cleans them all up, and you get a nice peak at 170 GeV, even as you start going to higher and higher pileup. So with the high energy of the LHC, the high luminosity at the LHC, and the high stakes for finding new physics at the LHC, cleverness is inevitable. And starting in the year 2008, with a paper by Butterworth, Davison, Rubin, and Salam, introducing some nice jet substructure techniques, as well as earlier work that Mike Seymour did in the 1990s, anticipating some of these methods. Yeah. Up to a point. So
yeah,
here,
so yeah. Because I thought they were saying like 25 events per something like that. They were getting crazy
numbers. No. So what's really cool here is that trimming keeps working up to, let's say, somewhere between 25 and 50.
Oh, okay.
And then when you start to, that this technique stops working, there's other techniques called area subtraction, which also have a comparable reach into kind of the 25 and 50. And if you put both of them together, then there's some evidence that you can go all the way up to 200. Now, of course, there's a distortion.
Yeah.
So you can't expect it to be perfect, but it's no longer a showstopper.
Yeah.
So you might have thought that this contamination was just, you can't fix it all, and instead it's the opposite. In fact, you can see a little bit here. It's hard to see, but this blue curve has some characteristic width, and it's hard to tell, but actually the width is even narrower, even with no pileup. So even with no pileup, you're already cleaning up a little bit of the underlying event activity that's correlated with the collision that you have. So these techniques, far from being kind of random things that you do to jets to clean them up, actually end up being quite powerful for extracting substructure. And now it's just a question of, will your detectors keep up? Are the detector granularities going to maintain where they are, such that you can actually apply these techniques?
I see, because it will degrade with time.
Well, it's energy resolution, but I'm even thinking of, you know, for these techniques to work, you're starting to probe jets down to the 0.1 angular scale. Mm-hmm. And 0.1 angular scale is roughly the same size as the calorimetry that you're talking about. So it's not clear that you could really push this much beyond 200 primary vertices. Yeah. So this plot from Gregory Soye is just showing the number of papers per month as a function of time. And, you know, okay, so I've contributed some to this rise, but zillions of different jet substructure techniques. And, you know, you can go to any number of different talks of people telling you their favorite method for analyzing jets. I have my own favorites. But all these techniques are basically trying to do very similar things. And there's kind of these four core principles of jet substructure that these techniques are trying to approach. You want to have some measure of prong-like behavior. If you're looking for a boosted top, you want some measure that the thing is three-prongy. If you're looking for a boosted Higgs or a W or a Z, you want some evidence that the thing is two-prongy. I'm not going to talk very much about these, but there's a whole variety of things in the literature that are doing testing for prong-like behavior. What I am going to talk more about is radiation patterns. When you have just a single subjet or a jet by itself, there's different radiation patterns depending on whether you have a quark or a gluon jet or subjet. So the color factors of quarks and gluons are different, and some of these techniques exploit the fact that gluon jets are fatter compared to quark jets. And we're going to talk about what we've learned from QCD by studying these radiation patterns. One thing that's been really cool is flavor tagging. This has been entirely experimental, where we know that there's B tagging algorithms to look for a B meson within a jet. And experimentally, now you can actually look for jets that have two B mesons in it. So you can imagine a boosted Higgs going to BB bar, and you can see two B mesons within the same jet. And B tagging algorithms have been suitably modified to allow for that flavor tagging. And then finally, this issue of pileup mitigation is, you know, one of the big, big things, and a variety of new pileup mitigation tools. For example, recently, some ideas called Puppy and Soft Killer Okay. As the jet literature has gotten longer, the names have gotten crazier. But these also are quite promising for even going beyond this 200 number of primary vertices. Okay. So from this point on, I could tell you. Well, charm, you get a little bit of separation, but okay. So charm tagging and B tagging are kind of in the same realm. The big flavor tagging you want to do is quark versus gluon. Yeah. And so I'm going to be spending at least 20 minutes talking about quark versus gluon, okay. And I'll explain. That is the white whale of jet substructure. Everyone is looking at quark versus gluon, and the person who solves quark versus gluon will make a big impact on new physics searches. And that's the kind of flavor tagging. By the way, I should say this flavor tagging, quark gluon, or even B tagging, is also relevant for the heavy ion community because they're studying things like jet quenching. And they want to know, are quark jets or gluon jets or B jets, are they quenched in different ways? But to do that, you need to be able to tag it. And so there's some nice crosstalk between the jet substructure folks and the heavy ion folks to come up with ways of robustly tagging. And the pileup that we deal with, you know, that's just the QCD fireball. And so, in fact, there's an exact match between some of our goals and the heavy ion goals.
Oh, that's not the kind of fireball they see.
What?
That's not the kind of fireball they see.
What? They
that's
have.
Not the kind of fireball they see.
No, no. Their fireball has azimuthal correlations, which pileup does not.
It's a much more dense medium through which this is where the medium through which.
Sure. No. What I mean in terms of the final state, what they're seeing.
Don't get quenched.
No, our jets don't get quenched from pileup. I'm not claiming it, but I'm saying the final state is the same thing. That is, you have this layering on. In their case, it's azimuthally correlated, whereas pileup is not. You have this layering on of radiation, of which you're trying to study something on top of it. And that's what I mean, it's the same. And what they need to do is subtract off that fireball radiation, just like we need to subtract off the pileup. Obviously, the physics is very different. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah. Yeah.
Follow up and filtering or pruning do for the
pileup mitigation? Essentially all techniques, partly the reason why I'm not spending much time on these, is that all techniques, when optimized, perform basically the same. And that actually is a little bit of a confusion, which I'll try to explain a little bit towards the end of the talk. But filtering, trimming, pruning, are what we introduced earlier this year called soft drop, these all have comparable performance once optimized. These techniques all have multiple tunable parameters. And as long as you tune and optimize, then you end up seeing comparable performance. And that's, in some sense, one of the confusions is these techniques all look very different. Why are they all performing in similar ways? And I'll give you a little bit of a sense of that in the second part of my talk. Yeah.
But you said if you combine trimming and another thing?
Yeah, I didn't put up here. The thing that's complementary to trimming is called area subtraction, where you treat the pileup radiation as if it's a uniform spray across your jet. These techniques are looking for lumpy behavior, and so they can correct for lumpy behavior. So if you correct for lumpy behavior and then also correct for uniform spray, then those things are complementary. But two lumpy tests, like filtering and trimming, you're not gaining that much information because you're essentially testing the same property of the jet, the lumpiness of it. And so you need to take lumpiness plus some smooth correction factor, and that has the best performance. And these new guys, like Softkiller, for example, is something that's trying to remove that smooth component. And soft killer works better when it's applied with one of these other things to get rid of the lumpy pileup component. Okay, so I'm not going to tell you much about these. Instead, I want to take a different tact. And I want to take the tact of using these new jet substructure techniques as motivation to delve into some subtleties of QCD. And when I gave the title of non-perturbative QCD and jet substructure, I do have examples that are both in the perturbative and the non-perturbative realm. But I decided, just for the interest of time, to push a bunch of those examples to the backups. So I'm happy to tell you more about really explicitly non-perturbative things. But I think most of us have a better intuition on the perturbative side. And so this is going to be a better starting point to talk more about perturbative aspects of QCD. OK. So I just told you there's all these techniques. And the first thing you'd say is, well, can you predict how these techniques actually work? Of course, you can run a simulation and run your simulation and see how it performs. But you want to know, is there any way to get first principles understanding of these techniques? And the standard lore, if you want to get first principle understanding of anything in QCD, is that the observables you want to study are infrared and collinear safe. And I'll explain to you what that infrared and collinear safe means. And one of the surprises, which was certainly baffling to me, is that a lot of jet substructure is based on observables which are, strictly speaking, not infrared and collinear safe. And that seems to call into question the entirety of the jet substructure literature, because you essentially lost your analytic control. And what I'm going to show you is that actually you can recover that analytic control with a new concept that we call Surdakoff safety. So that's where I'm going. Okay, so what is infrared and collinear safety? So this is a cartoon version. So there's actually no real Feynman diagrams in this talk. So what is infrared and collinear safety? What we know about QCD is that there are two types of infrared divergences or low energy divergences in QCD. If I take an original jet and I emit an infinitesimally soft gluon, there's a divergence for that to happen in a real emission diagram. Similarly, if I take a constituent of the jet and split it into two, there's a collinear divergence associated with that, that diagram. These divergences, which occur in real emission diagrams, are canceled against equivalent divergences in virtual diagrams, and via the KLN theorem, these divergences will cancel as long as you have an observable which is infrared and collinear safe. And infrared and collinear safe means that your observable itself is insensitive to arbitrary numbers of infrared emissions or arbitrary amounts of collinear splittings. In particular, when I have arbitrary numbers of collinear splittings, I would get a bunch of divergences, but if my observable is insensitive to those divergences, then when I combine with virtual diagrams, I'll get something that's perfectly finite. And the standard lore is that if you are infrared and collinear safe, then you are not only calculable in perturbative QCD, that is, you see this cancellation order by order in an alpha S expansion of real and virtual divergences, but moreover, your non-perturbative effects, effects that are associated, let's say, with hadronization or whatnot, but those are also perfectly controlled. And contrary-wise, if you are infrared and collinear unsafe, then there's no possibility of being calculable in perturbative QCD because you don't have a cancellation of divergences order by order in an alpha S expansion, and you have no control over hadronization effects. That's the standard lore. And over the past 2 years, I've realized, and there's precursors of this in the literature even, that actually this whole table, this way of thinking, is not really the right language to talk about things. I have examples that basically fill out this whole box. So I have examples of infrared and collinear safe observables, which are fully calculable in perturbative QCD, but you have no control over hadronization effects. I have examples, and this is the one I'm going to show you right now, of observables which are unsafe, yet still perfectly calculable in perturbative QCD, and examples of unsafe observables where you even have control over hadronization effects. And in some sense, the language of safe and unsafe is not the right language. It's degrees of perturbative control, and there's a mismatch between these different ways of thinking. Yeah.
So if you roll back a decade or so ago, when folks could use those higher unsafe quantum algorithms,
yes.
Are there known examples where like you've got a completely wrong answer?
Ah, good. So let me give you two answers to the question. So the examples where you had like the unsafe cone algorithms, like seeded cone algorithms, those ones I do not know how to fix using my thinking. And those are cases where I think they're still sick, but I haven't been able to quantify it. But there's other examples of unsafe observables. For example, one of the original ones was called, sphericity or sphericity. Which one was the first one? I think it was sphericity, which was claimed to be something you can't calculate. And yet now we know how to calculate that particular distribution. In the cases where things didn't seem to go wrong, like you run in Monte Carlo, it seems to work fine. Some of those cases I understand why it works so well. But in some sense, the fact that we never saw big problems with the cone algorithms at Tevatron was already giving us a little bit of a hint that this was not the right separation. And the specific thing that we'll see coming up is that it's not a good idea to think about observables order by order in an alpha S expansion. There you can get yourself very confused and convince yourself that things are worse than they really are. And it's by thinking a little bit more holistically that we'll be able to break free of the bonds of infrared and collinear safety. Okay, so for those of you who don't think about infrared and collinear safety, let me just give you some examples so you know what the observables we think we can study are. So for example, I take a collision event, I look at a jet, and I sum up all the transverse momenta of the constituents of that jet. That's safe. Why is it safe? Well, if I take a particle, split it into two, well, I just sum them back up together. Or I add an infinitesimally soft particle, PT doesn't care about it. So jet PT, which of course we study all the time, that's something that's infrared and collinear safe. That's something that we think we can calculate in perturbative QCD. CMS came up with this awesome observable that they call PTD. This is a good quark gluon discriminant. I'm not sure how they came up with it, but it's actually in some sense a natural extension of jet PT, You just take the constituents of the jet and you sum the squares of their transverse momenta and normalize them in some way. This one's infrared safe because if I add an infinitesimally soft gluon, I don't contribute to the sum. But it's not collinear safe because the sum of the squares is not the same as the square of the sums. And so when you split a particle into two, that square is not safe. Jet multiplicity, which is something that gets studied all the time, is not infrared and collinear safe because it's just summing up one for each constituent in the jet. Clearly, if I add a particle or split a particle into two, that one changes. Jet mass is something that is infrared and collinear safe. We study jet masses all the time. Something that I worked on with an MIT undergraduate student, Ken Van Tilburg, called N sub jettiness. This also is infrared and collinear safe. And this observable, you know, it looks complicated, but it's basically saying to what extent is radiation aligned along N sub jet axes. And so I can tell you more about this if you want, but because it's linear in transverse momentum, just like the jet PT is linear, the fact that it's linear is one of the reasons why this is infrared and collinear safe. So these are the things that we think we can study. And from these things that we think we can study, we can now ask, okay, can we predict jet substructure observables from first principles? Can we actually study infrared and collinear safe jet substructure observables and actually gain analytic understanding of how these methods work? Okay, so this seemed like a natural thing to do, especially since we developed the sense of jettiness, which we purposefully designed to be safe. We said, fantastic, this thing is safe. Let's go to town and calculate till we're blue in the face. And you know, I have colleagues at MIT like Ian Stewart who know how to do precision jet calculations and said, let's just calculate this thing. Fantastic. But we ran into a little bit of a snag. Can we predict from first principles? Looks a little bit problematic. Because the thing that's safe is, let's say, N sub jettiness. But the thing that experimentalists find useful is not this by itself, but ratios of N sub jettiness values. For example, this study from Atlas was looking at the ratio of tau 2 over tau 1. This is saying how 2 sub jetty is a jet compared to how 1 sub jetty is a jet. And this ratio has this behavior where if the ratio is close to 0, then it's like a two-prong, let's say, W jet. This thing is the observable.
Yes, but as a function of what? So you take the jet, this is a, what is the x-axis?
The x-axis is this observable, tau 2 over tau 1. So for each jet,
yeah.
I calculate this thing for tau 2, saying how well is radiation lined along two prongs, and I get some number.
Okay.
Then I say how well is radiation lined along one prong, I get some number. Each one of those numbers is fully calculable.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
Right. And then I take the ratio of them, and then from the ratio, I just build a histogram.
Okay.
And they build a histogram. And what you see here is one, this is data with 35 inverse picobarns. Okay, so there's no boosted Ws in this sample. This is from 2010 data. And it's supposed to be that if you have ordinary quarkish or gluon-like jets, then this shin should peak at large values, and indeed it does. And the other thing you see is pretty good agreement between the black, which is the data, and the empty histograms, which are different Monte Carlo programs. And you see there's a good agreement. And this is extremely confusing for what I'm going to tell you next, which is that, well, let me come back for a second. So I know how to calculate this in principle. What I need is the ratio. And the reason why I need the ratio is typically because I want to look at things that are scale invariant, or at least approximately so. This thing is dimensionful. And so it's helpful to use a dimensionless ratio. And that's why they are studied, for example, by Atlas and CMS. But the thing that was totally blew my mind is that if you have an infrared and collinear safe numerator and an infrared and collinear safe denominator, the ratio itself is unsafe. And this fact was pointed out by Suarez and collaborators in like some footnote in a 2012 paper. And I saw this footnote and I say, no, that's not possible. Look at that amazing agreement. And why did I say, look at this amazing agreement? Because these Monte Carlo programs, Pithy and Herwig, they're not just random. They're based on perturbative QCD. Built into their structure are, you know, Altirelli-Parisi splitting functions. You know, they know about QCD. And we thought that we had no analytic control over things that were not safe. And yet here, pretty good agreement for something that apparently is unsafe. And so this started me kind of in a tailspin of trying to say, wait a second, how am I going to help experimentalists calculate this ratio if what I'm trying to do is completely unsafe?
Yeah,
no, I'm not. I have three slides trying to walk you through this because this is like deeply perplexing to me. Okay, so what? Safe over safe is unsafe? How is that possible? How is safe over unsafe possible? And by the way, I went into the details of distribution theory trying to find ways around this, and no, it's really true, it's unsafe. So it's confusing because experimentally, you measure A, that's safe. You measure B, that's safe. Each one of those things, A and B, individually, fully calculable. From that ratio, from A and B individually, you infer the ratio. The ratio corresponds to lines of constant slope that pass through the origin. And this observable is unsafe because typically for these jet substructure observables, and subjettiness in particular, there's a singularity at the origin. And when you have distributions, in distribution theory, it's perfectly fine to have a singularity in one place. We have things like plus function prescriptions for dealing with singularities at one place. But here, every value of the ratio is visiting that singularity. And because every value of the ratio is visiting that singularity, every value of the ratio is sensitive to, for example, non-perturbative physics that might be lying at that singular regime. So I'm going to give you another way to look at this in a second. One thing that you can do is you can put a cut on the denominator. So if you put a cut on the denominator and only look at values of the ratio such that I'm above some cut for B, then you can cut off that singularity and have an observable that is safe. But that's not what the experimentalists measure. They didn't put any cuts. They just took right out of the box the ratio. And strictly speaking, right out of the box, this ratio is unsafe. And, you know, I was taught you only tell experimentalists to do smart things. Well, good. So that there are experimental cuts. For example, I can't measure particles that are arbitrarily soft, and I can't measure separations that are arbitrarily small. So in that sense, there's a physical cut. But what we would normally say is that those physical cuts, there's natural cuts also from hadronization effects itself. But normally what we say is that it's really bad if your observable is sensitive, not just to lambda QCD, but sensitive to the granularity of your detector. That's another type of thing where we think we don't have control. Because if you're sensitive to the granularity of your detector in some extreme way, then your answer is going to change.
But that's different, right? Like that's when you actually want an answer, a numerical answer. Then you depend on the cutoff. But here, the issue is not that you have a numerical answer. The problem is that you don't want to be sensitive to the origin, and you're never sensitive to the origin.
Well, good. So the question is, why are you never sensitive to the origin? So in a fixed order calculation, you are really sensitive to the origin. Like you literally try to calculate it and get infinity, because there's not a cancellation between real and virtual diagrams. That's the problem, is that I can't even calculate it order alpha s to the 1. Okay, so let me just give you another way of understanding what's going on here.
But is that more a problem of fixed order QCD than a problem, or rather applied to this observable than a problem with
unit type? So that's where we're going to get to, is that this is a problem of fixed order QCD. And I think to people who work on fixed order QCD, the idea that there might be things that are not calculable within the context of fixed order QCD, it would start to make you worry, because the way that I'm going to do the calculation is still based on perturbation theory, but it's just not fixed order perturbation theory, and that's, at least for me, it was worrying.
Just to get back to Itai's question, so even if you forget about the issue of detector granularity,
yeah.
If you just theoretically impose the cuts that would correspond to the detector granularity, would you expect a problem?
Oh, good. So what you find when you do that, if you impose the cuts that correspond to the detector granularity, you find that the distribution looks nothing like this. That is, at fixed order in QCD, it's not just a problem that you need to make sure it's not infinite. It's that you just get the totally wrong physical picture for what's going on. And you'll see that in a second, that putting a physical cut, you get large logarithms of that physical cut value, and those logarithms are so big that you don't think that perturbation theory is even trustable. And so you've lost perturbative control, and the resulting distribution you get doesn't look like what the data says it should. Okay. So I'm gonna walk you to this point in a second. So let's show you a simple example, at least simple from my point of view. So this is an observable called angularities. And these angularities were developed in 2003 by Berger, Cooks, and Sturman. And they introduced these as a way to just test QCD for the purposes of E plus E minus collisions. And they did a bunch of calculations that unfortunately have never been tested on data for what this particular distribution looks like. So what is this distribution? It's something where, so it's, I'm going to call it E sub beta. So beta corresponds to this exponent here. And what I do is I take a jet, and I take each constituent of that jet, and I say, how much momentum does that constituent have? And then how far is that emission away from some axis, let's say the jet axis. And the way this thing works is that if all the radiation is all aligned along the jet axis, then these angles are zero, and this thing goes to zero. Whereas if the radiation is widely spread out, then these angles are large and this thing is large. And if I raise this angle to a different power, beta, I can test different regimes of QCD. Large values of beta are testing wide-angle radiation. Small values of beta are testing smaller-angle radiation. And that's why Berger, Cooks, and Sturman advocated for this as a nice test of QCD. And I'll show you a little bit later on that this is also a nice test of quark gluon discrimination. Okay. And so this is the angularity. And let's just take the ratio of two of them with different angular exponents. So the ratio is E alpha over E beta. Let's see what happens in QCD. Okay, so I have a jet. So here I have a jet. And if I just have no emissions in that jet, just have an iconal quark or gluon line flying past, then this observable is just zero, and I get zero over zero. So to have even something sensible, I better have at least one emission. So I have one emission. That emission carries a certain momentum fraction of the original jet, and that emission is happening at a certain angle. And so if I just plug in that one emission into this formula here, the angularity is that momentum fraction times the angle raised to the beta power. And this thing is perfectly safe. Why is it safe? Because in the infrared limit, where this emission goes to zero, this thing goes to a well-defined value. It goes to zero. In the collinear limit, when this angle goes to zero, such that I get a collimated jet, this thing also goes to zero. So this observable is safe because it has a well-defined property in the soft and collinear limit. But if I take the ratio observable, then what do I see? Oh, shoot, this factor of z cancels between the numerator and the denominator. And so I get a ratio that depends only on the angle of the emission. That means I can have an infinitesimally soft particle. It's only because I did it for one, exactly. But I have an infinitesimally soft particle, and that infinitesimally soft particle can give me arbitrary answers. So if I only work to order alpha s, then I get infinity. I don't get a cancellation of the real emission diagram, which has a singularity at z goes to zero, and the virtual one. Yeah.
But this is precisely why I don't believe it, because when they calculate that thing for the histogram, you can just calculate the numerator separately, the denominator separately. Both of them are perfectly finite.
Yes.
If they're finite over finite, you'll get a finite answer.
So, but the issue, but
exactly.
Yeah, no, but the and so I agree with you, and that's what I'm going to show you. It really does work, but it doesn't work based on fixed order perturbation theory.
In the sense that you definitely have to cancel divergences from the virtual diagrams, for sure you have to do that.
No, but it can't.
And when you calculate the denominator, you get a finite answer. You get calculate the numerator, you get a finite answer.
So let me. I mean, I can be very particular about this. People have said about jet substructure, why are you running all these Pythian, Herwig, Monte Carlo programs? Let's run MadGraph, because MadGraph, or let's say, or any other fixed order generator, and you find precisely this issue. I mean, this is this annoying thing that was buried in this footnote. It really is true, and they actually.
I don't know what I mean by true.
Sorry, Jesse.
Yeah.
Is what you're saying essentially that fixed order over fixed order, when you do a Taylor expansion
yes.
of the denominator,
yep.
1/(1+x),
yep.
is no longer fixed order?
Correct.
So what you're proposing does not meet the definition of Jesse being fixed
yes.
order.
Yes.
That's
right. Right. So the solution is as you're anticipating. Well, let me just show you one other way of understanding why there's a problem. There's a divide by zero problem. That is, this ratio has this denominator, and this denominator at fixed order and perturbation theory has the classic singularity associated with any kind of mass-like observable. That is, this singularity corresponds to, in the real emission diagram, a rising. This rising is canceled by a virtual diagrams living at the origin, but there's basically a singularity going up to zero, and so I have a divide by zero problem. I have a singular region of phase space where the denominator can get arbitrarily small. Of course, the answer is that, come on, don't work at one order in alpha s. Go to all orders. And what we know happens is that when you go to all orders in a perturbative expansion, you know that for this distribution here, you get large logarithms of the observable. And if you take towers of terms at, let's say, alpha s to some power and log squared to that same power, you get a series that you can resum. And that resummation of that series gives you precisely a Sudikoff form factor. So the singularity at zero is not physical as long as you account for all orders in an alpha s expansion. And in fact, that singular region is perfectly cut off. There's zero probability to get actually zero. And so this is not the right answer for the ratio. You need to account for many emissions. So you can work to this issue is solved already at leading logarithmic accuracy. And as long as you account for all orders in alpha s, you can get a finite distribution. And so we call this type of observable Pseudakoff safe because it's a Pseudakoff form factor that's regulating an apparent divergence. But it still leaves you with the problem that, okay, yes, there might be something regulating the divergence, but how do you actually go about doing a calculation? And so the key realization about how you can actually do a calculation despite this singularity is by saying, look, what I'm actually doing is precisely what you said. You said, look, I can simultaneously measure these two things. Each one is finite. And the words that you just said, that I can simultaneously measure E alpha and E beta, that's saying that the double differential cross-section is perfectly finite. If I take this double differential cross-section and project onto the ratio by integrating over the observables and just taking the delta function constraint to look at a cross-section that depends on R, which is E alpha over E beta, then I get some distribution. And the surprise, you could do this calculation quite straightforwardly, the surprise is that at order alpha s, when you just have one emission, even though this thing is perfectly finite, the projection is not. That is, you have some distribution, which itself is finite, but its integral is singular. And that's maybe not surprising. But that means that this thing itself cannot be calculated. You can calculate this, but you can't calculate what the experimentalists actually measure. And the key realization is that this same formula holds all the time. And in particular, if you can do find a Pseudakoff form factor that simultaneously resums large logarithms in E alpha and E beta to all orders in alpha s. If you can find that, and by the way, this is precisely what Parton-Shower Monte Carlo programs do. They generate arbitrary numbers of emissions, and those arbitrary numbers of emissions are precisely generating Pseudakoff form factors simultaneously for these two observables. If you can do that, then when you do this projection, you're going to get something that's finite. It's going to be Pseudakoff safe, is what we call it. But it's non-analytic in alpha s. It can't be expressible as a Taylor expansion, because if it were expressible as a Taylor expansion, then you could work to order alpha s to the 1, and you would have gotten something finite there. So just as an engine for generating distributions, the thing we have to do is do what the experimentalists do. You measure the numerator, measure the denominator, project onto the ratio. And that means what you have to do is do this joint resummed calculation, which I'm not going to tell you how precisely we do it. I have a bunch of backup slides about it. But let me just show you what the answer is and show you where this non-analytic behavior in alpha s comes from. So here at leading logarithmic accuracy for these ratio of angularities, here's the final answer. Okay, it's not very pretty. It has exponentials. It has error functions. God. But you can now ask, okay, what happens in the small alpha s regime? If I tried to do a Taylor expansion of this formula, what would I find? And what you find is that at small alpha s, you find that this thing behaves like the square root of alpha s. There's a color factor for whether I have a quark or a gluon. But you know, the key thing to focus on is the square root of alpha s behavior, which is still perturbative. That is, this is a small-ish number to the extent that alpha s is small. But this is a distribution that cannot be obtained at any fixed order in perturbation theory, and that you need to do a resummed calculation to gain access to the square root of alpha s behavior. Okay. So this is what we say. It's unsafe. There's no Taylor expansion for this. I can't directly calculate this as a Feynman diagrammatic expansion. But it's still calculable. There's still a finite cross-section if I account for leading logarithmically enhanced terms at all orders in alpha s.
You're going to tell us how you got
it. I'm not going to tell you. If you want in the backup, I can absolutely tell you how we did this. What? No, but partly why I'm, well, okay, I'm happy to tell you how we did it. Can we save that for the end for Q&A? Yeah. Because it actually isn't that interesting how we did it, because all you're doing is calculating a Pseudakoff form factor, but it's just a Pseudakoff form factor that depends not only on one observable, but two. So you do the same kind of Pseudakoff logic, only with two observables instead of one. And I'm happy to draw pictures for that at the end to show you how it happened. The key insight is that you can take that double Pseudakoff and project it down to a single observable, and then you get this funny behavior. Now, okay, whatever. Oh, sorry, before I go to whatever. Just to say that also this whole thing is systematically improvable. So I did the lowest order goofy thing, which is this leading log, which encodes the Pseudakoff form factor and gives me something finite for a distribution. You can match to fixed order calculations. So even though the fixed order calculation by itself is not safe, you can match it onto the Pseudakoff factor and get something that's finite. Of course, you need to account for the fact that alpha s runs, and alpha s running is not a small effect, so you get this green curve when you put in running alpha s. And then you have to account for the fact that there's multiple emissions within the jet. You could even introduce hadronization corrections as part of something that's known as a shape function, and you get a distribution here. My colleagues, Andrew Lakowski in Malt and Duff Neal, actually did a next-to-leading logarithmic resum calculation for this distribution. And what you find is that actually the convergence isn't that bad, and this thing converges on something that's very similar to what a Parton-Shower Monte Carlo program does, because a Parton-Shower Monte Carlo program precisely accounts for these effects. These effects dominate this distribution, and we get now predictions for jet substructure from first principles QCD.
Can I ask a very dumb question?
Yeah.
So why does it work so well, the ratio to 2/1, then? Do you understand that? Even that you know now.
It's because this distribution is dominated by resummation. If the distribution was dominated by fixed order effects, then it would have been a Taylor expansion.
So you're saying that automatically they do resummation when they calculate Pythia and everything. That's Pythia
is a resummation. Pythia, formally speaking, Pythia is this whole list of terms. Pythia is a Sudikoff form factor.
Yes.
At least certain processes in Pythia even have tree level matching.
Yeah.
Alpha S is running. There's more than one emission in the jet. It actually gives you like actual jets. And there's a hadronization model in it. The thing Pythia does not have is this NLL formal correction.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing is not, I mean,
it's not as important.
I mean, it is important to get something that's really accurate. Mm-hmm. But the Monte Carlo program has all the effects that you need. Whereas fixed order only has this leading order tree level piece, which is not a good description of what the distribution looks like because the distribution is dominated by this all orders in alpha S. It's dominated by the singular regime at the origin.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, so the multiple emissions, there's a sort of analytic way of determining the...
Yeah. So I have that also in the backup. So
okay.
So essentially...
We'll let you come back to it then.
Yeah, no. Well, I may not have time. But the way you account for multiple emissions is you simply say, I have a jet and I can emit one particle in my jet, and there's some probability to do that. But then I can also have another emission in my jet that can give me a comparable contribution to the cross section. And then you just write down the formula for I have 0 emissions, 1 emission, 2 emissions, 3 emissions, 4 emissions. You realize that whole thing can be transformed into a certain function, and you just apply that function. So it's easier than it sounds. It's basically just you have a resum calculation that you then resum again in some sense. You resum the possibility of multiple emissions. So you may say, okay, whatever, you know, that's interesting, but square root of alpha S is not that surprising. And by the way, we're not the first people to find square root of alpha S behavior. People who do thermal field theory, for different reasons, but people who do thermal field theory also find square roots of coupling constants. In the pink book of QCD, square root of alpha S appears in the anomalous dimension of fragmentation function moments, so maybe an obscure appearance of square root of alpha S, but an appearance nonetheless. And so you might say, come on, you know, this Sudikoff safety is just a little bit of a parlor trick. You're showing that a ratio, which you already thought should be calculable, is calculable. And yeah, maybe it is a parlor trick, but let me just show you one example which totally blew our minds because we weren't expecting it. So this next slide has no apparent connection to Sudikoff safety. But we've introduced earlier this year, Andrew Lakowski, Simone Marzani, Gregory Swaya, and myself, we introduced a procedure called soft drop. And soft drop is a procedure to take a jet and throw out soft wide angle radiation for the purposes of trying to remove pileup. And this procedure has some parameters, it has two parameters, some energy threshold below which you say it's most likely pileup, and some angular exponent beta that was inspired by this angularity beta. In the soft drop procedure, you can dial this beta to different values. If you dial beta to be infinity, then your jet is not changed. If you dial it down to minus infinity, you completely obliterate your jet. From the standard accounting of unsafe versus safe, safe is positive values of beta, unsafe is negative values of beta. And beta equals zero is kind of interesting because that turns out to be directly related to the so-called mass drop procedure that Butterworth, Davison, Rubin, and Salam introduced in 2008, in some sense started this whole business of jet substructure. There was a nice follow-up paper by Dasgupta, Fergesa, Marzani, and Salam doing analytic calculations of this beta equals zero regime. And so we said, great, we have the soft drop. We can interpolate different values of beta. Let's do a fun calculation. And so the calculation we decided to do was to take a jet and just ask how much collateral damage is this from this grooming procedure. You're trying to remove pileup, but maybe you remove some radiation that you shouldn't have removed. And then what happens in that case? Well, you want to calculate the fractional energy loss. So you calculate the fractional energy loss. You go to this interesting beta equals zero limit, and you find a distribution that has no alpha s's in it. You needed alpha s to do this calculation. You needed to resum terms all order in alpha s, but at the end of the day, the function that you get is some alpha s independent function, at least if you neglect the QCD beta function. So if you take beta naught of QCD, set it equal to zero, then you get just some distribution that doesn't know about coupling constant. In fact, it doesn't know about quark versus gluon to leading order. It's even independent of the jet PT and the jet radius. This is something that is a standard candle, as best as we can have it, for jets. And it's a Sudikoff safe observable. This does not have a Taylor expansion in alpha s. It doesn't even start at order alpha s. And if you just plot this thing in Monte Carlo, you get some really cool features. So for example, at the LHC at 14 TeV, you find that whether you're talking about 200 GeV, 1 TeV, or 3 TeV jets, this collateral damage has this more or less universal form. For fun, Andrew and I did this 100 TeV study, and whether you're talking about 1 TeV or 20 TeV jets, it's pretty similar distributions, and it agrees well with the analytic form. And so this is telling me that the Sudikoff safety is not just a parlor trick. There's something deeper going on, and somehow it smells like there's another way of talking about QCD observables, where maybe the coupling constant isn't even the right expansion parameter. In this particular case, it looks like the beta function is the right expansion parameter, which is kind of a strange thing. Okay. But again, the strategy for doing this calculation was exactly the same as what I did before. You calculate a double differential distribution for two things. You marginalize against one. You get a distribution that happens to have alpha s dropping out, which is quite surprising and crazy. Unfortunately, with this is the collateral damage. But that's something that's not easy to measure experimentally, because you're trying to get rid of the pileup. So you get rid of the pileup, you get this collateral damage as well, but you can't separate the components. And so we're actively working to try to find examples that are actually measurable in data to really test whether these type of distributions really exist in nature. Okay, so let me switch gears. Let me just pause for a second to see if there's questions on this. Oh, yeah, sorry. This observable has two parameters.
Yeah.
One of them is this energy threshold. And so this distribution cuts off, well, these actually are secretly two different versions of the distribution. So if you look on this side, there's a strict cutoff at 0.1.
You put it by hand. Right?
Yeah, the grooming procedure has two parameters, Z cut, the energy threshold, and beta. And so you fix Z cut at 0.1,
yeah,
and then study the distribution as you take this beta down to zero.
Does this mean you're very sensitive?
The observable has that log of 1 over z cut in it. So the normalization and the shape of the distribution cares about that cut.
Yeah.
But the subsequent behavior after that is independent of alpha s and doesn't care about the cut value. So the cut value tells you the range at which you should look at the observable.
Yeah.
And precisely your concerns are what concerns us. That is, we would love to have an observable that didn't have this extra parameter in it. And we think we have examples of ones that don't have that extra parameter in it, so that you actually get a more universal function, one that doesn't have this extra parameter dependence in it.
And it's also alpha s independent.
So once you know the trick to how to build alpha s independent observables, you start seeing them everywhere. Because getting rid of alpha s is essentially doing a clever change of variables, and so you need to check that change of variables removes alpha s to some order, with then corrections that show up when you actually account for the running. And I also have examples where the running effects are even parametrically small. Again, I'm not confident that they're actually measurable, but you can at least do calculations for them. Okay.
So what does this observable actually teach you?
This particular one teaches me nothing, apart from the fact that there's a lot more than infrared and collinear safety. Infrared and collinear safety says march order by order in alpha s. Sudikoff safety says, actually, what you need to have is something that's resummable at some basic level, and then you can get very bizarre analytic structure in alpha s. And this last example is the most extreme version I know, where alpha s was crucial for doing the calculation, and if you tried to Taylor expand in alpha s, you'd find an essential singularity, so that you can't actually do any kind of expansion of this guy in alpha s.
Yeah. But it looks like you're still very sensitive to this cut.
And yes. No, absolutely. And so that's why we're working on versions of this that are cut independent.
Okay.
Now that we know what the trick is, So that we had to figure out what the trick was. How did you get this alpha S to disappear? And now, having seen that trick, we're trying to come up with new observables to satisfy that.
How do you know that the resummation is mathematically correct?
Ah, excellent. So at the moment, the only thing that we can check is we can check that when you put hadronization corrections in, that the hadronization corrections don't modify the distribution. What we don't know formally is we don't know whether when I resum for the double differential distribution, whether when I project down to the single one, whether I have a controlled expansion. So going back to this formula here, all the formal statements I can make are at the level of this object. And I can make precise statements at the level of this object. And when I say the accuracy of a calculation, I can refer to that, because that thing is safe. And therefore, I can use all the standard tools to figure out how resummation works and factorization theorems and all that on this. But when I project down, I lost that handle. And so for us right now, we define the accuracy of this calculation by the accuracy of that double differential calculation.
Because if you do resummation series, you provide by interchanging.
Absolutely, interchanging. That's exactly right.
Fraught with problems.
That's right. And so the context where we understand this best are contexts where we have a formal factorization theorem, for example, in the context of soft collinear effective theory, where you say, at least at the perturbative level, you know what it means to resum. And my colleagues who did this NLL calculation, they precisely showed where the regimes of validity of the factorization theorem are. And it's actually really interesting. They end up finding that there's not one factorization theorem you need two of them, and then you need to interpolate between them, that you can actually show that there's not enough of a hierarchy of scales to generate a trustable factorization theorem in general. But you can find a factorization theorem in one regime, a factorization theorem in another regime, and there appears to be a unique interpolation between the two of them. And that then defines the accuracy of their calculation. But that's something that we should obviously be very worried about. Are these really systematically improvable beyond these ones, which I think everyone would agree are doable?
The bottom line is the Taylor series has an essential singularity.
Right, and so now, that's right, so you can ask reasonably the question, what's the radius of convergence? Well, we have the same problem already in perturbative QCD, right? So there's a formal radius of convergence is zero. So if you have a formal radius of convergence of zero, you then have to ask, okay, when do I start running into problems? And it's entirely possible that these distributions, by the way, which are obtained using Monte Carlo programs, that you'll measure it on data and you'll find something completely different, in which case you've gained evidence that actually maybe the resummation is not appropriate and that you're fooling yourself. So that's why I want to find observables that are actually measurable to do this. Okay. So, so I have a whole other part of my talk. But I have 3 minutes left. So
it's okay. People are grown-ups. People can leave.
Okay, so if people want to leave, they're welcome to leave. Let me go a little bit fast through this. But I think it's, I'll just go through it. You can leave if you want. Okay, so mutual information with the truth. This is something that that we learned from our friends in information theory, and it was for the purposes of chasing this white whale of jet substructure, which is telling the difference between quarks and gluons. And just for motivation, beyond the standard model signals often are quark-rich, whereas standard model backgrounds are often gluon-rich, and one extreme example is some R-parity violating supersymmetry scenario that has 10 quark jets in the final state and no gluon jets. So if you can statistically separate quark jets from gluon jets, then you're doing a good thing. The kind of intuitive picture for why quark jets and gluon jets are different is that quark jets have a smaller color factor than gluon jets. So gluon jets are going to have more copious radiation, wider angle emissions, fatter structure, whereas quarks are going to be more narrower, more confined. And if you can find a way to test for these different color factors, you might be able to enhance searches for new physics like this. The essential challenge is that as I'll explain momentarily, that if you only take into effect these color factors, you can actually show on general grounds that if you have some technique that has an efficiency factor for finding quarks of 50%, then it has a gluon mistag probability of 50% raised to the 9/4 power. And 9/4 is not random. 9/4 is just the ratio of 3/4. And so in this particular case, 50% quark efficiency
comes with it a 21% mistag rate. And that's why this is the white whale. People have been chasing this, trying to drag this mistag rate down, 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 essentially trying to find things beyond the color structure of jets in order to do better discrimination. So we waded into this game of...
What is
that?
What is it entered in the power CF? Is color factor?
Yeah, color factor. So this is in the large end limit.
Yeah.
Gluons have twice as much color as quarks because it's two color lines.
No, that's true. But why does it enter in the ratio?
Why does it raise it here?
Yeah, what's the ratio there?
Okay, you'll see this three slides from now, why it's this. But the reason why it happens is because if I take into account a Sudikoff form factor, a Sudikoff form factor is precisely the integral of how many events lie between one value and another. And Sudikoff form factors have this property known as Casimir scaling, where Casimir scaling says that if I want to go from one color factor to another, I take this integral and just change the exponent from CF to CA. And switching from CF to CA is the same thing as multiplying by the CF over CA factor. And that's why it ends up showing up here. Okay, so we waded into this game of quark-gluon discrimination by introducing a whole generalized family of angularities, which I'm not going to tell you about. But these angularities are just like what you saw before, which is this line here, but it's a two-parameter space where we can interpolate between all sorts of things that people have talked about for quark-gluon discrimination, jet multiplicity, CMS's PTD, the mass of a jet, the width of a jet. And all of these things are measuring the gluon radiation around a hard jet core, and therefore you might think that you could actually tell the difference between these two types of jets. And the main thing that we added to the literature with respect to these observables is we used observables where we really were measuring the gluon radiation about a hard jet core. That most people have measured radiation with respect to the jet axis, but the jet axis actually can move around when you have radiation. So you can have radiation that moves the jet axis around such that it's not well centered along the hard core of a jet. And if you want to make an observable that actually has the measurement axis pointing along the hard parton direction, you have to define your axis a little bit differently. And we define the equivalent of the median of a jet that locks onto the top 50% of the radiation and does a better job of measuring actually this gluon radiation about a hard jet core. I can tell you more about that offline. Okay, so the question we had with these observables are, can we understand quark-gluon separation from first principles? Can we figure out what it means for to have a sample of quark jets versus gluon jets? How well can we extract information about quarks versus gluons? And that word information kind of rang some bells for us. We said, oh, good. We should scour the literature on information theory, finding all the various measures of information content, and see which one actually gives us the best analytic handle on quark-gluon separation. And the one that we came up with is called mutual information. It's related to Shannon entropy. And it's something that measures the overlap in information space between two observables. So this area of A here is kind of the information space, information content of observable A. B is the information space content of observable B. And their overlap tells you how much information is shared between two observables. It's a way of testing correlations between observables. And the thing, yeah.
Do you mean information principle or the information actually contained
in a thing? The information in principle. And the modification that we made of this information in principle was not just the information that's available in principle, but the information that's available in principle that's actually useful. So this thing turns out to be not a useful thing to calculate, but the next slide is useful to calculate.
So when you talk about information, is that just the probability that you can predict something else?
Yeah. So what this is saying here is that if I make a measurement of A, how many bits of information have I learned about B by making that A measurement? That's what this overlap means. When I measure A, I've learned a certain amount of information about the value of B. If B was entirely contained in an A, then measuring A would tell me everything I needed to know about B, in which case measuring B is completely redundant. But this thing is not actually that helpful because I don't care about how observables are correlated. I care about how much observables have overlap with some fictitious truth that I might care about. So truth in this game would be talking about whether I have quark jets or gluon jets. So if I have quark jets or gluon jets, that's one bit of information. Is it a quark jet? Is it a gluon jet? If I'm doing an analytic calculation, I can tell you whether my analytic calculation is for quark jets or gluon jets. But if you just measure an observable A and you don't know the truth, you want to know how much is measuring A telling me something about the truth. And this overlap of the information content of A with the truth is something that you actually care about, and you want to know, hey, how much, if I measure, you know, the mass of a jet, can I tell the difference between a quark, which let's say is zero, versus a gluon, which is one? Can I get access to that one bit of truth information that I need in order to do quark gluon discrimination? And from this formula, you can actually calculate what the information content is if I only had color factors. So if I only have color factors, then I only have these Surikoff form factors, and the probability distributions are derivatives of those Surikoff form factors. So the probability distributions for quarks and gluons for essentially any observable that you've ever seen looks basically like this. You have something that rises and falls, something that rises and falls. It doesn't really matter what that functional form is. It's going to rise and fall with some separation between the two. And if you calculate this information theory quantity, it's some universal function of CF and CA. Involves hypergeometric functions, not particularly intuitive. But the overlap of essentially any observable, if you only have color factor information with the truth, is 0.1. And 0.1 is a lot less than 1. And this is why it's this white whale. I'm trying to get precise quark gluon separation, and the only information content that I really gain is 0.1 of a bit. I can have the craziest observable in the world, but as long as it has some Surikoff form factor structure, I'm not going to do better than 0.1. And in some sense, what you want to do is you want to go beyond that that 0.1 of information content to enhance quark gluon discrimination power. Okay, so we did a bunch of tests of this. So let me just show you this space. So this is the space of these generalized angularities. You have things that are safe, things that are unsafe, things that are quasi-safe, and this is the non-perturbative part of my talk, where actually there's regions of this angularity space where you can actually relate an unsafe distribution to a safe distribution plus a little bit of non-perturbative input.
Are you saying that we're normal? Like, are you saying that you can't?
No, I'm just saying
with only the knowledge of the color factors, then there is no better you can do.
Okay.
And so you need something beyond color factors. And now we want to know, where is that additional information hiding? And the next slide will show you that we have no idea where that additional information is hiding. So here is this nice rainbow here. This nice rainbow is saying, how much overlap do I have with the truth? So 0.1 is this very pessimistic, I don't have any information. 0 means I might as well just flip a coin. 0.3 is the best I've ever seen. And now you can ask, OK, can I separate quarks and gluons from each other by testing different calculational methods? OK, so at leading log, when I only have the Surikoff form factor and nothing else, no matter what I try to do with these angularities, no matter what weighting I do for energies versus angles, I always get this pale yellow color, which is to say that I don't, it doesn't matter which one I use, they all perform equally poorly. If I go to next to leading logarithmic accuracy, where I actually account for additional properties of quark and gluon jets, like subleading terms in the splitting function, running alpha S effects, I see that I go from this pale yellow to green, so I have a little bit more information content, though this has large error bars. And then the frightening thing is if I now go to the standard Monte Carlo programs that are out there, let's say Pythia or Herwig, you see quite dramatic differences in how those programs think, or what these programs think, about the overall information content available for quark gluon discrimination. Pythia here has this nice blue region where you actually get up into information content of like 0.2 of a bit, whereas Herwig kind of stays in this pale yellow. And what this is telling you is that these programs, even though they're based on the same approximations, the choices that these programs make with respect to quarks and gluons are small as far as, you know, the perturbative accuracy, but huge when it comes to quark-gluon discrimination power. And experimentalists have complained that they run Pythia, they get really optimistic answers. They run Herwig, they get really pessimistic answers. And what they see in data seems to be somewhere in between. And indeed, from an information theory point of view, we can see what's going on. We can see that these programs actually have different estimates of the information content relevant for quark gluon discrimination. This, despite the fact that these programs were tuned to similar amounts, similar types of data, and these programs, in terms of the raw distributions, actually look quite similar to each other. So the real power of this method of mutual information, and the reason why we adopted it, was because it allows you now to study, can things get better if you start measuring more things about a jet? If I only measure one thing about a jet, I'm in this ambiguous situation. Maybe things get better if I measure more things about a jet. And the cool thing about mutual information is that it makes it very easy to visualize when an observable is or is not going to help. So I have observable A, which has some information content, observable B, which has some information content. And even if these guys don't have much overlap with each other, if they overlap the truth in exactly the same place, then these variables, we call them redundant. Yes, they're getting more information. You can measure A, you can measure B, you're learning more things about the jet, but you're not learning anything relevant for actually doing what you care about, which is quark-gluon discrimination. And there's examples like this in the literature where experimentalists will say, oh, observable B is a crappy observable because it's not helping me. Well, it's not helping you for that particular purpose. It's still adding information, just not useful information for the purposes of discrimination. Similarly, when we have complementary variables, we say that we have two observables whose overlap is small, and where they overlap with the truth, they overlap in complementary ways. And so what you'd like to hope is that when you start adding more observables, you're going to get more discrimination power because you're going to add additional overlap with the truth. So for example, if I take along this line, these are the safe angularities that you heard about in the first part of the talk. At leading log, measuring two things, you actually gain a little bit of information, but it's still this pale yellow. And next to leading log, you are entering into the green regime, maybe even getting a little bit blue. And then, unfortunately, adding more information just adds to the confusion between these two Monte Carlo programs, that Pippi and Herwig, their information content is getting even more separated. And in particular, if I just ask how much additional information did I gain from going from one versus two, here this is showing that as I add more information, Pythia gains even more compared to Herwig. And so not only does Pythia more optimistic on one observable, but somehow it has interesting correlations in it that make it even more optimistic when I measure more things at a time. And this is something that's super serious. You know, if we think we can understand QCD, then we better understand how these programs are working, what information content they think that quarks and gluons have. And at the moment, I'm perplexed as to how these programs could possibly have different information content, since their basic structure is based on the same perturbative understanding.
Well, but that's not really. You know that, I'm sure you know that, yeah. Herwig and Pythia do the showering pretty differently.
So angular order versus non-angular order might be something there.
And it's more than that, right? Like Herwig actually tries to keep the coherence.
Right, there's the gluon coherence effect is there. I guess my confusion is that the real.
I don't think it explains it. It's not too surprising that it's different.
The particular reason why I think it's surprising is because all of the things that Herwig has in it that improves its description are things that should go in the direction of making quarks and gluons look more dissimilar. That is, the things like color coherence and such actually should be going in the direction of making Herwig be more optimistic, and yet somehow backwards. And so that's why I'm confused. Again, as you say, maybe it's not surprising that they're that different, but it is surprising that it's different in the way that it is based on what I know how the shower works. So it's clearly something subtle that needs study. And then just finally to show you that even at the non-perturbative level, these are purely unsafe distributions, no hope of calculating it, at least using current methods. And you know, we just see, just by eye, very different information content at the hadronization level. And maybe something in the hadronization is telling us something. Maybe the cluster fragmentation versus string fragmentation is giving me more of a difference. But the confusion is, even when I turn off hadronization effects, I still see large differences. So, but it's something that worth understanding better.
Go back in three slides.
Yeah. Here?
No, one more.
One more here.
So do you understand the upper left corner, why the next leading log seems to think there's lots of information?
Yeah. So this dashed line here is showing the range of validity of our next leading logarithmic calculation. I said it too fast, but this regime here is safe, fully calculable using perturbative QCD. This regime is quasi-safe. That is, I depend on one non-perturbative input parameter. And this regime, you need a whole non-perturbative function to even start to describe that. You need a generalized fragmentation function to start. So where these programs disagree up in the corner, I have no control. I do know that this behavior is the one you expect on intuitive grounds. And we are perplexed that our next leading logarithmic answer gives the backwards. But I don't see any reason to distrust this calculation within its range of validity. Though if we went to higher order, we would hope that we'd be able to fill in this regime and that it would go in the right direction.
Okay, so it actually looks like
And that's the confusion, is that Herwig formally should be more closely to this. And there's a very different, I mean, essentially this one looks like that, apart from this upper corner. And it's as if Herwig is not accounting for the extra information.
Except
for they're formally they are with what's going on in the program. So it's we're obviously working with Monte Carlo authors and tuners to figure out how this could possibly be true. And just to maybe not bash on these programs at all, these programs have phenomenal accuracy. The total amount of information content, like this overlap here, it's like 7 bits of information. And they predict very well, and they agree with each other on those 7 bits of information. But you don't care about the 7 bits of information. You care about that 1 bit, or 0.1 of a bit, relevant for discrimination. And so if you have a 10% error on 7 bits, I mean, of course, bits don't scale in this way, but if I just say it this way, if I have 10% error on 7 bits, 0.7 of a bit, and I'm trying to tease out information at the 0.1 or 0.2 bit level, it's not surprising that these programs are disagreeing. And so it may be that, and that gives us a new target for accuracy for predicting this discrimination power. Yeah.
Why would you expect principle discrimination coming from a common gluon within the hadronic channel, which is colorless?
That's right. So as you say, the hadronic observable that I have is colorless. And so if I try to calculate the color of a jet, of course it's not colored. So why do we think that there's even a well-defined definition of quark versus gluon? Right. That's kind of what you're saying. Why do you think that they should be different or not? And the answer is that if I took an Iconal Wilson line and laid it down, and I really had an Iconal line that I could measure the radiation pattern for an arbitrary amount of time, then I would be able to see that if I had a larger color factor, this Iconal line that I'm kind of dragging through will keep emitting more and more and more if I'm a gluon, and will emit less comparatively if I'm a quark. So if I'm really in the Iconal limit where I can drag something for a long period of time and watch the radiation pattern expand out, in that case, I actually can, by making an infinite number of measurements, actually figure out what the color factor is from the radiation pattern that I see at long wavelengths. Of course, the Iconal limit is not where we are at a collider. So at a collider, we don't have that much room between when I make a quark or gluon versus when I get to hadronization. But at least in principle, there's a limit that I can go to, extremely high invariant mass, where I can watch the quark or gluon evolve for a very long time, and its radiation pattern will be correlated with the color factor, at least in this Iconal limit. So that's why we think there's a limit where it's well-defined. And the cool thing is that the Iconal limit is essentially the soft collinear limit, roughly speaking. So in the extreme soft collinear limit, the extreme resummation regime, you think that this picture roughly makes sense.
I'm trying to see how much a quark is confined compared
to gluon. How much a quark is confined?
Compared to
a— Right, well, so that's what these observables are in some sense trying to do. They're trying to ascertain, is there something in the radiation pattern for each individual emission? Can I sum up over enough emissions so I can see that at least statistically there is a difference in the radiation pattern from one emission, and then exponentiate that to get the whole structure? And again, there's a limit where this is well-defined. Happens not to be the limit where we have experimental access right now, but you can still ask the question on simulation, can you see the separation? If you're worried about that, what the experimentalists who are working on this are actually doing is they're saying, let's look at the information content, not of quarks versus gluons, but let's look at events which we think are quark-enriched versus events which we think are gluon-enriched, and check their information content. So for example, gamma plus jet events are thought to be quark-enriched, whereas dijet events are thought to be gluon-enriched. And so you can play the same information theory game on gamma plus jets and dijet events and see if there's a separation. And that's at least a well-defined way of testing quark versus gluon.
Trying to probe the deep secret.
Maybe we should try to just finish. Yeah. Sorry, that's a finish.
Yeah.
He's here for a long time.
Yeah. So let me just conclude so we can talk even more about this. So what did I try to tell you today? I tried to just give you a very brief introduction to jet substructure. And you know, just as the sales pitch, the LHC is forming phenomenally well. The granularity of the detectors are phenomenal. We can actually look inside of a jet. And because of the extreme kinematics, the extreme luminosity, and the hunt for physics in and beyond the standard model, that's why jet substructure has become so important experimentally. But the thing that I find really exciting is that jet substructure has enabled us to ask questions about QCD that we just never thought were interesting. For example, these ratio observables were never interesting in any other context but this jet substructure, so no one ever figured out that there was this other category of observables, Sudikoff-safe. And what we're learning is that if you look at things all orders in alpha s, we're learning something about the structure of quantum field theory. And exactly what we're learning is what we hope to understand, but at least we see a way beyond the standard paradigm of infrared and collinear safety. And then I just went super fast through this mutual information with the truth, which is a nice robust test of discrimination power, and highlights something that the experimentalists have already seen. They've seen that for what they want, for this ill-defined concept of quarks versus gluons, they're seeing that different simulations and different calculations are giving different results. And this mutual information is a nice way of visualizing it and calculating the discrepancy. And the hope is that by continuing those calculations and those studies further, we may gain insights into this deep mystery, as you say, of QCD. Okay, thank you.
So I guess we've already had a number of questions.
Yes.
Is there any more really pressing ones?
Well, he was teasing us with those deck of slides, but
Yeah. So I've zillions of these. So let me let me just show you this. You wanted to see the square root of alpha s?
Yeah.
Okay. So the simplified picture of how you calculate a jet is you literally just take an icon of a hard quark gluon line and you have a haze of soft gluons around it. And in the soft collinear limit, you can just talk about the probability for an individual emission as being a color factor, and then this characteristic dz over z d theta over theta, where z is the energy fraction that you're familiar with the splitting functions, and theta is the splitting angle. And if you're trying to talk about a Sudikoff factor, the standard Sudikoff factor is the probability to get a measurement below a certain value of the observable. So because you want to work to all orders in alpha s, you have to exponentiate this probability. But you basically say, what is the probability to emit any one of emission? And let me enforce that that one emission would not saturate my observable. Of course, you can go more detailed and make sure that you don't have multiple emissions that saturate the observable. And that gives what we mean by the Sudikoff form factor. And that gives you this suppression, because the singularity, when it's thrown into the exponent, gives you actually a reduction the cross-section. So then to do the same thing for two observables, you just replace the theta function. Just replace the theta function with two restrictions. And then what do you get when you do that? Okay, that's going to give the probability to get a measurement that's below both one value and another. From that, you can take two derivatives to get the double differential cross-section. From that, you can get the ratio. And the Sudikoff factor is calculable, the double differential is calculable, the ratio is calculable, increasing level of ugliness, and that thing turns into this result that I showed you already. So it's actually really straightforward, as long as you account for the fact that the Sudikoff factor can have needs two types of vetoes, veto on two observables, and you could generalize to three or more if you wanted to.
Okay, let's thank Jesse again.